6:15, Dave Cohen in for Tommy Tucker. Glad to be with you on this Wednesday morning here on WWL. Keep the text coming on the Oakland Heart Jewelers Talk and Text Line at 504-260-1870. Well, we welcome in Robert Hogan, Professor and Department Chair of Political Science at LSU. Good morning, Professor. How you doing?
Good morning. I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm doing very well, thank you. President Trump pretty excited about announcing a new trade deal with Japan late last night that allows more U.S. goods into Japanese markets and lowers the tariffs on Japan to 15%. Your thoughts on that as the whole tariff back and forth continues with nation after nation around the globe?
Yeah, I mean, this is something that Trump promised many months ago, that he was going to renegotiate the trade deals the United States had with countries around the world in order to get a better deal for America. America was not getting the deal it should get. It was being cheated, as he often likes to say. And a lot of critics of the president have said it has taken a lot longer to make these trade deals as he had initially promised. And so he is able to come through and say, at least on this country, there is in fact a trade deal in place, or is the framework of one that they're going to finalize in the coming weeks. It allows the president to say he's making progress. Of course, for Democrats and some of Trump's critics, even on in his own party, are saying that this isn't happening quickly enough. And the concern is a lot of these really, really high tariffs that he imposed on countries might kick in and might be a drag on the economy if he doesn't, act as swiftly as he needs to. So it's good news for the president, but probably not swift enough for those who are critical of him.
Yeah, he said overnight in a post on Truth Social that Japan will invest $550 billion in the U.S., and 90% of that will be profits for our country. He also said Japan will open their country to trade, including cars and trucks from America, rice, and other agricultural products. That's got to be exciting to the automakers and to the agricultural industry, because Japan is a huge market.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, having access to their markets is something that will help manufacturers here. I mean, the whole point of the tariffs is to make it where, it's people will want to do business with the United States, and it will make foreign goods less favorable for Americans to purchase. The whole point of the tariffs, he goes on and on about tariffs raising revenue. Of course, tariffs, they're imposed here in the United States, are really like taxes and are a drag on the economy, given that it affects consumers. A lot of what he's trying to achieve are long-term changes in what's going on. And so these are things that will probably, to the extent that they have benefits, it will be many years out before we actually are able to see those.
Yeah, it's a risk-benefit analysis, I guess, and for many people, the pain is so intense here on the front end. Several reports now saying that major retailers like Amazon have cranked up prices 20 to 40% in line with the tariffs that have been placed on various countries around the globe by the Trump administration and by the president. But he's banking on the fact that ultimately this leads to lower prices, leads to more U.S. manufacturing, more foreign investment in the U.S., more U.S. jobs, and in the long run. But do Americans have the patience to wait it out while he goes nation to nation and tries to heavy-handedly force them to commit to better trade deals by threatening these huge tariffs?
No, absolutely. I mean, this is something that will take a large amount of time, and probably a lot longer than some people think. I mean, it's one thing to say we want to increase manufacturing in the country to produce goods that we sell abroad. It's another to actually have a company say, hey, this is something that's going to be profitable. We need to build a factory that builds these things. We need to hire workers. Those are things that take many years. And so if if these trade deals are meant to, if people are expecting these trade deals to immediately, with a the snap of a finger, to result in an economic blip on the gauge there, that is not what's going to happen. I mean, you're absolutely right. These are long term things that the president's putting in place, and it's going to take a long time to see any sort of benefit from that economically.
Yeah, it's not like the president says, hey, we can start selling cars and trucks in Japan now, and Detroit just suddenly opens a showroom in Japan and ships vehicles over there and starts selling them. They've got to be manufactured. They've got to be transported. There has to be an infrastructure for that. So it is detailed and time-consuming, and we shall see. We're talking with Robert Hogue, an LSU political science professor and chairman of the political science department, about the president and his popularity. When we get back, we'll talk about recent surveys on the president's popularity, as the surveyors saying that the president's lost significant numbers, but the White House pointing to the president being what they call the most popular Republican president in history within his party. What's the difference, and what does it all mean? We'll ask Professor Hogan that after we check on WWL traffic. We're under an extreme heat warning today, starting at 10 a.m., because the National Weather Service says conditions will create heat index values of up to 114. Already feels over 100 in several locations. But we also have heavy rain on the way. It's just off to our east, off the coast of Louisiana now, and that's going to continue with showers on and off today, tomorrow, Friday, Saturday, and probably wrapping up before Sunday. So we'll watch all of that for you here on WWL. I'm Dave Cohen, in for Tommy Tucker. Robert Hogan, the professor and the chairman of the political science department at LSU, is our guest. Professor, surveys out this week, polls of Americans showed that President Trump's approval rating has dipped about 10 points since February. But the White House says that's not a true illustration of what's happening, saying that 90 to 95% of Republicans still approve of the president, and they say that's what matters. They call him the most popular president with his party in American history. Tell us the difference between those two statistics and those two polling numbers we're seeing out there.
Yeah, I mean, what they're saying is I would not disagree with. I mean, it is true that he has great support within the Republican Party. I mean, regardless of what sort of issues face the president, even in the face of this Epstein scandal that is brewing, Republicans are staunchly supportive of the president. A lot of people like to say that Donald Trump has a low ceiling overall in terms of general popularity among the public overall, but has a high floor in that those Republicans are very supportive of him regardless of what happens. And indeed, if you look, over the past, ever since he's, coming back into office in his second term here, he has had generally low approval rating. Right now it's sitting, it's in negative territory in the sense that more people disapprove of him than approve of him overall. It's about 53-44, 53 disapprove, 44 approve. But you have, again, a high number of people who are Republicans, who identify as Republicans, who say they are supportive of him. The last 2 weeks, you've seen a bit of a dip. Some people think that may be in response to Epstein. And that's one of the reasons that the Epstein issue is so critical for Trump, and why we see him attempting to change the message in the way that he has. Some of his core supporters are people who are very much in the category of voters who believe in a lot of these conspiracy theories. A lot of them were motivated to take part in the election because they felt that there was a cabal in control of the government, in which pedophiles were controlling parts of the government. And, Trump promised to get to the bottom of this. And he keeps saying they're going to do that. And, of course, with the Epstein files, his unwillingness to release those, I think, has had some of those core supporters. I don't know if they've moved away from him yet, but they're getting a little softer than they were. And this is
So interesting that the opposition's coming from both hardcore Republicans and staunch Democrats. But he has been successful in getting Speaker of the House Mike Johnson to back off, and they just went on break from Congress without taking up the Epstein files. What happens next?
Well, I mean, the question is he able to change the subject before Congress comes back into session in September? It did sort of mute the ability of the opposition or those who are concerned about Epstein to bring up the issue, but it's not certain that that's going to be something that's going to be sustainable going forward.
All right. So all summer long, we're probably going to hear more on the Epstein case, and we'll see how it all plays out. Professor, thank you for joining us. Have a great day.
You too. Take care.
I'm Dave Cohen in for Tommy Tucker. Coming up next half hour, Scoot will join us to talk about the legacy of Ozzy Osbourne. He's played concerts here in New Orleans several times, and now he has left this world. What's his legacy going to be? We'll talk more about the death of Ozzy Osbourne after the news. He has gone home for the last time. Osbourne, the Prince of Darkness, as he was known, died yesterday. You know, one thing amazing about Ozzy Osbourne is nearly everyone on the planet knows who he is. He was able to stay relevant for some five decades. I remember when I was in elementary school becoming familiar with Ozzy Osbourne after he bit the head off of a bat during a concert of Black Sabbath's. And since then, he has managed to keep himself relevant. Scoot from WWL, Scoot on the Air, was lucky enough to have the opportunity to interview Ozzy Osbourne and see him perform. I never got that opportunity, Scoot, but no matter what you thought of Ozzy Osbourne, he definitely was a master of keeping himself popular and relevant, wasn't he?
Yeah, and, you know, it was in early 2000 when the reality show The Osbournes came on, which I watched the original Osbournes every time it was on. I loved the show. That's what really turned him into a pop culture hero. You know, people had known him, but more people knew him from the reality show than actually knew his music. Because, you know, heavy metal is an interesting, very unique rock genre. And he was the Prince of Darkness. He did things, as you mentioned, like bit the head off a bat, but he did some other crazy things as well. So he was known and really was very influential. And people may not know this, but Ozzy was very influential in the role of the development of heavy metal. And he had this high-pitched screech that sort of became a signature element in heavy metal. He was kicked out of Black Sabbath in 1979 because of excessive drug and alcohol use. Now, I'm pretty sure those guys were doing drugs and alcohol.
Doesn't that typically go with heavy metal?
Well, yeah. I mean, to get kicked out because you did too much, he had to do a lot. Well, that's when he started his solo career. And by 1980, he had his own solo album, Blizzard of Oz, out. And Sharon really helped him with all of that, but sold 100 million albums and, you know, known in the heavy metal world, but also outside of that, mainly because of the show The Osbournes. He really became this cult hero in so many ways. And, you know, there's an interesting thing. In addition to biting the head off a bat, a lot of people don't know this, but in 1981, at a CBS Records executive meeting in Los Angeles, Ozzy was set to release a few doves as a gesture of peace, and he grabbed one of the doves and bit the head off of it. He spat the head out and had blood dripping off his lips. Of course, he was really drunk at the time, but this was at a CBS executive meeting. And then he's escorted out. He grabs a second dove and bites the head off of that. So
who thought it was a good idea to have doves around Ozzy Osbourne at a meeting of CBS? Yeah, let's bring doves to the meeting as a gesture of the peace that we're trying to establish here. Yeah, it seems a little short-sighted to have doves and Ozzy in the same room at the same time. But, yeah, I think you're absolutely right that keeping up with the Osbournes, or was that the name? Whatever the reality show's name was really brilliant in exposing him to generations who had never really known much about Ozzy Osbourne, probably never listened to his music. I was riding in the car yesterday listening to Ozzy music with my wife and noted, you know, at the time, Ozzy Osbourne's music was said to be so irreverent, so heavy, so off the beaten path. But we listen to it today, and it doesn't sound that shocking.
Well, that's almost the way everything is. I mean, look at the Beatles' hair, you know. I mean, you look at it today and it's like, well, those are almost crew cuts. But back then, relative to the times, I mean, that was really bizarre. And, you know, Dave, you know, Ozzy was related to satanic worshiping, and his music represented satanic worshiping. And this was part of the interview that I did with him at the Pensacola Civic Auditorium when he was performing there. But Ozzy was actually a member of the Church of England, which is a Christian Protestant church, and he was said to pray before every show. So kind of like Alice Cooper, he had this onstage persona that was totally different from who he was offstage. And I got a chance to see that when I interviewed him. And one of the things that I talked to him about was, this was a time when there was a lot of controversy about his satanic music, and I asked him about the case where a teenager had committed suicide, and the parents were suing Ozzy and CBS Records, his record company, over the death of their son. The judge threw the case out, saying that there's no link between Ozzy's music and suicide, even though the song the kid was listening to was Suicide Solution. The problem is, the kid was listening to the same song over and over and over again, and I talked to Ozzy about this, and he said, Scoot, you know, Ozzy said that basically this kid had to be strung out on drugs or alcohol or both. That was his exact answer to me, and that the normal person is not going to just go commit suicide after listening to music. And he was right. It wasn't the music. It was other things that were going on with this kid, and that's why the judge threw the case out.
We're talking with Scoo. I want to talk more to him about his interview with Ozzy and what Ozzy said about biting the head off of a bat and how that became kind of the identifying incident for the rest of Ozzy's life. When we come back after this, talking to Scoot about the life and times of Ozzy Osbourne on WWL. Ozzy Osbourne died yesterday at the age of 76. His loved ones remember him as a dedicated family man. The world remembers him as the Prince of Darkness, who really pioneered the sound of heavy metal music and will forever be remembered for biting the head off a bat at a concert in Iowa. WWL Scoot on the Air was able to interview Ozzy years ago. What did Ozzy say about that bat-biting incident for which many people will forever remember him?
You know, he first reported that it was alive. You know, after he said it was alive and it bit me while I was biting the head off of it. Well, it turns out that wasn't true. That the guy who actually brought the bat to the concert said it was dead when he brought it there. So Ozzy bit the head off a dead bat, but he was taken to the hospital and went through the inoculation.
Rabies protocol, yeah.
Rabies protocol. Went through all of that just to make sure. But, he just said it was just one of those things that he just instinctively did and didn't really think much of it. And, again, you know, thinking about the times that he bit two heads off of doves, I mean, he was really into shock. And again, I kind of relate him to Alice Cooper, who was a lot more popular in terms of pop hits. You know, Ozzy was in the heavy metal genre, so he did have some hits. But he was known for doing crazy things. I mean, in 1982, Ozzy urinated on a memorial in front of the Alamo in San Antonio. Man, that is an iconic figure in downtown San Antonio. And he was immediately arrested. He was banned from performing in San Antonio for 10 years. He sincerely apologized, made a donation, and he got back into the good graces of the city. But he was intoxicated at the time. So, you know, Ozzy, I in some of his interviews, he was sober when he did the interview with me. But in a lot of interviews I've heard him do, he's basically incoherent. I mean, you couldn't even understand what the guy was saying. He was so drunk and strung out on drugs.
Yeah, part of his image, and one thing's for sure, he knew how to control his image, shock people, yep. Get attention, and for 76 years, the guy was able, at least the last 50 years, maintain crazy popularity and at least notoriety, if not popularity. Thank you, Scoot. We look forward to listening to you from 1 to 4 today and every afternoon on WWL.
Thanks, Dave.
I'm Dave Cohen, in for Tommy Tucker. By the way, Ozzie said he thought the bat that a fan threw on the stage initially was rubber, and when he bit into it and realized it was real, he was shocked. But then he decided to use that to try and increase his popularity or notoriety. I'm Dave Cohen, in for Tommy Tucker. We'll be back after the news here on WWL. The dramatic saga of who's going to be picking up trash in the French Quarter has captured the local media, and people are hanging on each story to find out just what is up between the mayor, the city council, the contractors, and it's become quite the circus of news coverage. But to folks who live in the French Quarter, it raises serious questions about what kind of trash collection they're going to get. Is there going to be lemony-scented soap being sprayed to clean the sidewalks and streets? And what's the future for their quality of life? Glenn Bilby joins us now, president of French Quarter Citizens, board member of the French Quarter Management District. And Glenn, while many of us are just on the sidelines observing this, you're living it. And obviously for those of us who like to visit, play in, eat, drink in, and have fun in the French Quarter, it's a major issue as well, isn't it?
It is. Good morning. Hot morning. And we are on the front lines. You're exactly right. So we're hoping some resolution to this problem it comes up soon.
Well, here we are on July 23rd, and as of August 1st, the current contract with IV Waste is apparently up, or is it? We asked the city council who's going to be picking up trash in the French Quarter and the CBD after August 1st, and we were told, ask the mayor's office. We asked the mayor's office, and all we get is a statement that talks about their dedication to a clean city and that this will be decided in the courts, but we're only, what, 9-10 days away. Do you have a real idea of who's going to be picking up trash and whether or not someone's going to be cleaning the streets in the French Quarter after August 1st?
Well, I have to tell you, it is a little bit complicated. It would have been easier if we had allowed the current contractor, IV Waste, to continue with the emergency contract, which was for 1 year, to play out to the end of, I think, December 23rd. Instead, we have all these machinations of emergency contract and awarding to other people and rescission. And I don't think we're going to have companies picking up trash, that's for sure. Hopefully that there's a continuation of IV Waste, certainly into the legal aspects of this, both from a private citizen and from what there's a suspense of appeal in place right now with IV Waste and Henry Consulting. So hopefully we'll continue with IV Waste as this gets sorted out.
Well, we have until August 1st for it to get sorted out. What happens after that remains unclear. What is the status of this in the courts, and how do the ongoing lawsuits and expected hearings impact who's going to be picking up the trash?
Well, whoever's kept up with this puzzle, there's two. There's one that's in suspense of appeal for the contract that is, I think, headed toward the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeal. And then there's another one that's going to be heard today. You've heard from the private citizens in Judge Sidney Cates' court. So depending upon the outcome of that, it may be a temporary restraining order to moving forward with this contract. Now, French Quarter Management District has put out an RFP and selected IV Waste. You read that in the paper, and we're going to ratify that at a board meeting. So barring anything else, pursuant to the Senate legislature that was passed this past session, we will be able to contract ourselves for IV Waste for the French Quarter, not the DDD, but for the French Quarter.
Yeah, but even if the French Quarter Management District does select and ratify IV Waste, isn't that only if the city fails to select a contractor under the state law that was passed in this last session?
You are correct. If there isn't a legal contract in place, and right now there isn't one. So we're going on the assumption that there won't be one in the next 9 days, and we're continuing forward to what will be best for the quarter and the city.
So many questions, so few answers, and the bouncing ball continues as we talk to Glade Bilby. When we come back after this, I'm going to ask him about what the French Quarter feels and what the general sentiment is there, and if he knows why the mayor seems so intent on giving the contract to Henry when it feels like most of the French Quarter wants Ivy Waste. We'll continue the conversation with Glade Bilby after we check on WWL traffic. 7:24, Dave Cohen in for Tommy Tucker, talking with Glade Bilby, president of French Quarter Citizens. And Glade, it seems like every organization from the French Quarter we've talked to, whether it's yours or one representing businesses or any of the others, seem to be advocating for Ivy Waste to continue to pick up the trash and spray their lemony-scented soap on the streets and keep the French Quarter clean. Is there anyone advocating for Henry Consulting other than the mayor's office that you're aware of? And if not, why not?
No, there's nobody. And I tell people, come see for yourself. Come see what the quarter looks like now. It's never been cleaner. And that's what you're seeing. And that's what you're feeling. And that's what we want to continue with. Now that we know something can be done well, we want it to continue to be done well to the same sort of standards that we have now, that we know can happen. And so it's amazing that this entire thing is very confused. And I have to tell you that a lot of people are spending energy trying to make sure that the quarter is clean, that we're doing what's best for the city, which the economic engine of a lot of this region is. And it's unfortunate that we're spending a lot of negative time when we could be using the time more productive to do something. So we would love to keep the conditions of the quarter, and that's by virtue of Ivy Waste.
Have you been able to get a feel for, and given that you are a proponent of Ivy Waste, you want Ivy Waste to keep the contract, but have you gotten any answers from the mayor's office as to why they keep advocating so decisively for Henry Consulting to take over? Do we have any idea why this controversy even exists in the first place?
No, we could have our own set of conspiracy theories if you want to go down that route. But I think if anyone looked at the hearing Monday at the city council, you saw the three top people from sanitation, the operations, and the administrative chief administrative officer. They were kind of confused. They were saying that Henry Consulting's not ready. They were saying one day we're going to have a rescission of the emergency contract, and the next day we're going to go back and continue with Henry Consulting. So I think the entire thing is very confusing. And to the average person, they go, what the heck is going on down there? And that's where we all are. I mean, no, there's no real answer as to why and who is pushing for Henry Consulting other than the mayor's office.
Yeah, and it's just sad when any time, regardless of the players or the situations, when there's some political or personal fight unfolding in the very public eye that we don't necessarily understand, but people like you, people who live, people who work, people who play, people who visit the French Quarter really seem to be caught in the middle of what is either a political or personal fight that's going on between the mayor and the city council and pretty much everybody else involved.
Right. And I kind of look at it like if it ain't broke, don't fix it. And we're in that situation, especially when we have a fiscal crunch in the city to want to have a contract that is $2.1 million more than what we're getting now. Really doesn't make any sense any way you look at it.
Glade Bilby, anything else you want to share with us as we await today's court hearing, see what happens at the appellate level?
No, Dave, thanks for the opportunity to talk about these things and bring it up. And let's just have common sense prevail and do what's right for the French Quarter, the citizens and the businesses, and the 19 million tourists that come here every year. That's the important thing.
Glade Bilby, thank you so much for joining us. I know we'll be talking to you again as this continues to unfold here on WWL. I'm Dave Cohen, in for Tommy Tucker. I will say this, folks, as we now let Glade get out of the conversation, there's 171 days left till LaToya Cantrell is no longer the mayor of the city of New Orleans. We have an election coming up on October 11th for the voters of New Orleans to pick the next mayor. God, I hope this is one of many cautionary tales that make the voters of New Orleans seriously consider who they want to be the next mayor, and that they select someone, whoever it is, that's going to stop with this politics of personal attacks, of creating controversies where there are none, we're creating problems where they don't have to be. And God, please, let us get someone in office who's going to work for all of the people of the city of New Orleans in an effort to make it a better, happier, and more successful city. Because we can't stand much more of this crappy personal and political agendas that unfold before our eyes. Coming up after the news, we're talking Saints training camp with Mike Haas here on WWL. Yeah, the Saints are coming today back to practice at training camp in Metairie. Fans already lined up ahead of the opening of the gates, waiting for hours to get in to see the black and gold practice for the first time in the new era of Saints football. Joining us to find out what that new era may look like is the voice of your New Orleans Saints, Mike Haas. Morning, Mike.
Good morning, David. How are you?
I'm doing well. Hope springs eternal for some in the black and gold because they are already out there just chomping at the bit to see the Saints practice today as we now get the new era underway of Saints football. Your thoughts?
Well, we began with an excessive heat warning with temperatures that'll feel possibly around 114 with rain chances increasing through Friday. So, yeah, it feels like the start of training camp. Unbelievable. That's going to be something to deal with. Tough for the fans, tough for the players. So, you know, I think if they went to any of the mini camp, they didn't go to OTAs, but it's going to be an evolution. And I probably said this during mini camp. It's going to look a lot like mini camp. They're going to be in shells and helmets. There's no, you know, tackling, no hitting, no full pads until Monday. But it's real, right? I mean, it's a step in the right direction. And, you know, it is going to be a daily dissection focus, hyper focus on what the quarterbacks do. All right, that'll be the first, what the quarterbacks do. And so, but this begins the evaluation process. We spent a lot of time yesterday talking to Kellen Moore and Mickey Loomis, and it was more
Saints coach and general manager.
Right, expectations versus aspirations. A lot of the questions started as expectations and ended, well, these are our aspirations, and there's a lot, you know, a lot going on with this football team, and they don't. I think the evaluation process will be actually more challenging this time because there's no combined practices. It's just mano a mano with your guys. 11 practices in Metairie, then California, and so I think you'd love to see some separation at the quarterback position prior to these preseason games. I just don't think you're going to get it because it's your guys against your guys. And they, you know, they know each other. They've been doing the same thing since OTAs and minicamp. So it's interesting, but there's certainly a lot of other positions to look at beyond quarterback. I just kind of know what it's going to be like, you know, in the next, you know, 11 practices with, you know, how the quarterbacks do.
You know, you talk about expectations versus aspirations. We've seen a lot of teams in this era of free agency and parity in the NFL be able to go from worst to first, but we've seen others who slowly build and improve over years before they become a contender. What does your gut tell you in terms of this Saints team? Do they have the ability with a new coach, going to have a new quarterback, and a lot of new players and a lot of other positions, especially along the offensive line and now in the defensive backfield, does this team have the makeup to be one of those sudden turnaround teams like maybe the Washington Commanders and go from worst to first really overnight?
Well, I think they have the ability. It's hard to say if they have the talent right now. I mean, you just don't know. But the fact of the matter is, and despite the fact that the Tampa Bay Buccaneers have won the division 4 straight years, it isn't like it's been, you know, they were 13-4, right? I mean, it's been 9-8, 10-7, 8-9. I mean, it's been a brutal division. And so I don't think you have to be world beaters to be in contention with their division. That's the way it's been the last 4 years. As poorly as the Saints have played, they've been in this kind of conversation in the division until very late in the season. So I think that's goal one. So can they go worst to first in the division? Yeah. Are they going to be worse? Now, the NFC East last year with Washington and Philadelphia, certainly a much better division. But, yes, I feel like this team will be, can be, in contention enough to be a factor in the NFC South, because I don't care that Tampa's won it 4 straight years. Atlanta was right there last year, could have won it, probably should have won it, because the Saints should have beaten Tampa, and Atlanta was going to beat Carolina. So, yeah, I think that it's possible because of the division, because the schedule they play, this is what the NFL does. You know, you play a last place schedule. It's what you do with that. But, yeah, they can be clearly in contention in a division that's been typically up for grabs, you know, since the Saints won it in 2020.
We're talking with Mike Haas, the voice of the Saints, as the Black and Gold begin their first training camp practice of the new era today out on Airline. When we come back, I'll get him to make a prediction, if he can, of who will be the starting quarterback when the Saints start playing games that matter this season here in New Orleans. We'll continue the conversation with Mike Haas. Also, he mentioned several other positions up for grabs. What key battles is he watching through training camp as we wait to see what this team can do in this season? I'm Dave Cohen, in for Tommy Tucker, back with Mike Haas after this WWL traffic. At 8:17 on your Wednesday morning, in for Tommy Tucker, Ronald Sherpas joins us, professor of practice in the Department of Criminal Justice at Loyola and former NOPD chief. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, Dave. How are you?
I'm doing well. And, you know, NOPD every week sends us their preliminary crime stats, and we get them from the various organizations that track that, including the Metro Crime Commission. And they're really impressive right now. Every week, it's like, wow, murder down another 29% so far this year on top of double-digit declines last year. Any category you want to look at, with the exception of shoplifting, every reportable crime is down, down, down. And for someone in your position, it's got to be great to see that we're seeing levels of crime lower than most of us have seen at any time in our adult lives.
Well, I think it's wonderful news, and it should be well received. And the thing about this is crime is cyclical. I heard in your lead-in, crime does tend to have peaks and valleys, and right now we're in a valley, and that's great news for the people in New Orleans and for the police department. The two things that have to constantly be under awareness, particularly by the political leadership, is if we're experiencing such low crimes at the same time we're saying we have so few police officers, then maybe we just need to recalibrate that and determine what is the correct number of police officers against the workload. I'm not suggesting 900 is enough. I'm not suggesting 1,600 is the right number. But whomever is going to be the next mayor must make that a priority to bring in some outside experts who know how to do this and can do it quickly. Secondly, I'm going to try to say this the right way. A dysfunctional police department can increase bad outcomes in crime because they're not doing the good things that they need to do. A functional police department can help reduce crime, but neither of those are 100% responsible for the crime moving in either direction. So in the case of a good department, which I think we are today, understaffed is the constant refrain, which could very well be true. Good results are occurring. I think that represents a good police department. But there are other things clearly that are going on as well. They're outside the control of the police department. And as I say all the time, Dave, it really boils down to this. If a police department could by itself end all murders, robberies, and rapes, we would have none. Police departments can't do it by themselves.
Talking with Ronald Sherpas, what are the top couple of things you think that the New Orleans police and the community at large have been doing recently for us to be able to enjoy these historically low crime numbers, the lowest in 50, 55 years, depending on which statistic you're looking at?
There's one thing that's very important. The science in policing proves over and over again that proactive policing can reduce crime and not just shift it from neighborhood to neighborhood, but actually eliminate it. proactive policing is exactly opposite of only answering the police radio. I think the police department began to go towards more proactive strategies when interim superintendent Woodfork was there, because she said it out of her own mouth. She said, I want to get more proactivity behavior from our department to interrupt crime before it occurs. I have every reason to believe that Superintendent Kirkpatrick has continued that strategy. So, A, David, a police department that tries to interrupt crime before it happens proactively is always going to be more successful than the police department that's measuring how fast they get to crime reactive, which means you're just measuring how fast you are at being late. As it relates to the community, demographics change. If you have a huge cohort of young children coming up in conditions that are very disparate for them economically, socially, educationally, they can have impacts on crime. And going all the way back to Janet Reno when she was the attorney general, published reports that were predicting that these trends in crime would increase as some of these cohorts of children who are in really desperate conditions increase. I believe that. I've seen that happen in my career. So we could have a combination of a police department that's being proactive with the tools that it has. We should celebrate that. We might be seeing a drop in the number of at-risk children from very disparate conditions. And we also see a general change maybe in the way the city feels about itself. And then fourth, the bugaboo. When the police department has such a – the bugaboo is this, and you can't get around this. When a police department like New Orleans has experienced recently incredibly long wait times for response to calls of crimes that have already happened, across the country, Dave, people stop calling. And that can influence a crime total number, because if your car got broken into and the police said it's going to take 6 hours to get there, your neighbor says, I can't wait 6 hours. I'm not even going to call. That is a real phenomenon. It was a phenomenon when I was chief, and it's a phenomenon in our consultancy. So when we have very long wait times, and the NOPD is still suffering with some of that, you can see a reduction in the total crime numbers, particularly around property crimes, because people just don't want to wait for the police. A lot of news, but you got to keep your eyeglasses on.
We're talking with Ronald Surpass. We're going to take a break and check on WWL traffic. When we come back, I'm going to ask him about some more specific things that the police and the community need to do to keep the crime numbers low so we don't see that cycle bring it back to the scary numbers we saw just a few years ago on WWL. The NOPD says fatal shootings are down nearly 50% this year after big drops last year. Carjackings are down another 37%. Non-fatal shootings are down 26%. Almost every crime category except for shoplifting down double digits as we continue to see historically low crime rates continue to go in the right direction. Ronald Surpass is our guest, and as a former chief, I know you study these trends and you see these cycles. Have cities elsewhere been able to keep these cycles from reoccurring, and once they get to these low crime rates, keep them low? And if so, how?
Well, that's the way it works, Dave, is you generally have trends that go across the nation. You can have one or two cities that might be operating opposite of the trends, but generally these trends across the country are the same. As crime goes up, it tends to go up across the country. It comes down with some notable outliers. The key to policing has always been in the last 40 years. The police are successful when they're proactively involved in partnerships with their communities to prioritize problem solving. It's the communities that need to tell the police, in our neighborhood, school zone speeding is a problem. The police need to respond to that, not say we have something important to do. In another neighborhood, it could be shootings. In another neighborhood, it could be daytime business burglaries. So when we see across the last 40 years of policing where the police work proactively in front of crime, positively in partnership with communities and businesses, they can identify problems together and attach solutions. Community policing fails if you don't have a community government. All hats need to go off to Andy Copeland, who was the CAO when I was chief. He, with Mayor Landrieu's support, gave the policing, community policing officers direct access to the city services to fix those problems that were making people feel uncomfortable in their community, coupled with the officers performing bravely and professionally. Our approval rates during that era was anywhere from 55% to 64%, because the men and women carry the message. The city could fix the potholes. The city could fix the abandoned locks that the police department identified in partnership with the neighborhoods. And, Dave, what that ended up with is the partnerships in the neighborhoods created trust. If the police could help me fix this ongoing aggravation of abandoned vehicles and burned down houses and lots that make my children, hurt, and the city puts the police in the beginning of that process at the top of the list to solve those problems, it returns support to the police when they need to go get more critical information about crime patterns, crime trends, and candidly, who are the crime people causing the troubles. It works. It works incredibly well.
If they stay in touch with the community and they're aggressive, not saying, oh, crime is low, we can let our guard down, maybe, just maybe, the next time we see that wave of increased crime across the country, New Orleans can buck that trend. Look forward to talking to you again about this and hopefully continuing to talk to you, Ronald Surpass, about lower crime in the city of New Orleans. Thank you. Have a great rest of your week.
Thank you, Dave.
He's Ronald Surpass. I'm Dave Cohn. And, of course, in 171 days, we're going to have a new mayor. The police chief has said she wants to stick around. We'll see if that happens. She's been really successful. Will she be here for the next mayoral term in New Orleans or not? Only time will tell. All right, coming up next, we're going to talk about this new report that one in three Americans say they've slept with their boss. That's after the news on WWL. So we talked about the Coldplay incident where the cheating couple was exposed and happened to be an employee and her boss who were caught on camera and later we learned having an extramarital affair. Well, a new survey known as the Modern Romance Report that looks at people's relationship trends and how they interact with others, amongst the questions asked was, have you ever had sex with your boss? And one-third of those surveyed said yes. A much higher percentage admitted to at least flirting with a boss at some point in their career in an effort to try and get a raise, a promotion, or preferential treatment. And nearly half of those people surveyed said that they had had sex with, slept with, a coworker. Those numbers seem awfully high. One in three have had sex with the boss, and nearly half have had a relationship with a coworker. Tony Frana is the manager and a career expert with Bold, the professional networking site. Good morning, Tony. How you doing?
I'm doing good. How are you, Dave?
I'm doing all right. When you heard these numbers, did that seem high to you that one in three people have gotten it on with the boss and nearly half have slept with a coworker?
It is something that, the data certainly is very interesting. And I think what it shows, and as you just, kind of stated, a lot of these statistics that we found is that it certainly isn't something that is uncommon.
Yeah, I just wonder, one in three, but now that's not in their current job. That's at any point in their careers, in their professional lives as adults. Either way, probably not a good idea to sleep with the boss, and definitely not a good idea for the boss to sleep with people who work for them, correct?
It definitely can complicate things, right? Because, power imbalances, can increase the risk of favoritism and, of course, ethical issues. And so there, it's really important to have transparent policies as an organization around workplace romances, if you will. I think that, we spend a lot of time at our place of employment when we are working. And so you're working with other people and, when you work closely with other people, relationships certainly can develop either, more intimate by nature or, just as friends and colleagues. And so I think that the key here is policies are key. And in light of recent events, maybe it's a great time for companies to sort of dive in and review those policies that they have.
Yeah, it just seems that the chances for things to go badly when the boss is sleeping with someone who works for them, either for the boss or for the employee, from the boss's perspective, if the relationship doesn't go well, clearly they're worried about human resources issues and complaints to HR or lawsuits or other ramifications. But likewise, for the employee, if the relationship does not go well, then are they in peril of being fired, demoted, not promoted, or treated poorly from the boss because they had this sexual relationship that ended for whatever reason? It just seems like there's a whole lot of risk for the boss and for the employee.
Absolutely. And, I think it definitely, just by what the conversation is, it complicates things, really quickly, particularly if things don't work out. And it isn't just the two people involved in the relationship. Workplace romance can really strain the entire team dynamics, even you know, the entire company, depending on the relationship, I suppose, and the fallout from said relationship. So it's really important, again, to, you know, tread very carefully and to have clear policies. But policies are great to have. They have to be communicated and communicated really clearly so everybody understands, you know, what the requirements are for reporting these relationships or navigating them should a personal relationship occur. That communication can, you know, hopefully eliminate some of the complications that arise from relationships like this.
We're talking with Tony Frana, career expert with Bold. When we come back, I want to talk more about the interrelationships between coworkers and less about the boss-employee dynamic, because that's even more common, with nearly half of Americans saying they've had a romantic or sexual relationship with a coworker. What should you know if that's something that you become interested in, and is it something that you should try to avoid? We'll ask Tony Frana that after this. If you have a question or a comment, feel free to share it with us on the Equinart Jewelers talk and text line at 504-260-1870. We're back after this check on WWL traffic. The Modern Romance Report has found that 1 in 3 Americans say they have slept with their boss at some point in their professional lives, and nearly half say they have had a relationship with a coworker. I'm hearing on the Equinart Jewelers talk and text line from many people who are listening to this conversation who are telling me that they met their now spouse at work and started dating because they were co-workers, and a lot of other people telling stories about big problems that have arisen in their workplace because of people sleeping together. Tony Frana is the manager and a career expert with Bold, the professional networking website. Tony, are you surprised that nearly half of people say they've had a relationship, a sexual relationship with a co-worker, and what advice do you have for people if they do seek to have a relationship with someone they work with?
Sure. You know, I'm not really surprised. You know, we spend a lot of time at work, as I said earlier, with, you know, the same team, the same people, and, you know, it's 40 plus hours a week if we're working full time, and you likely have, you know, things in common with the people that you work with because you're working on the same team or within the same organization. So even your job titles might be the same. You may be aligned with the mission and vision of the organization, and it might be something that's very aligned personally with you. So there is that commonality amongst coworkers that just naturally sort of falls into place when you work at the same organization. And I think, you know, as people sort of get more comfortable with technology, and technology, I think, you know, sort of, you know, removes some of those lines between casual and flirtatious communication, even just sending a meme or a GIF, you know, to somebody that you work with. So I'm not surprised by this, but I do think that it does warrant employees who decide to, you know, embark on a relationship that is more than just being colleagues, that they, you know, tread carefully, think everything through, and of course, refer to the company policies to see, you know, what the handbook says about having a relationship with somebody that you work with that is, you know, outside of work.
Yeah, because the last thing you want is to think that, well, this is innocent, we're friends, why not make it more than that? And then you end up either in the HR office or losing your job because you violated a company policy. I'd say about half of the companies I've ever worked for had a policy strictly banning coworkers from extra work relationships, that you could not date or have sexual relationships with people with whom you work. But about half don't have such policies.
Sure, sure. Or the policy might be, you know, if you are to embark on a, you know, a personal relationship with a coworker, these are the steps you need to take to make sure that it is transparent. Because again, you know, it's more than just the two people who can be impacted by a personal relationship. And also, you know, depending on the dynamics of the team and, you know, who the manager of the team is, you know, is there favoritism? Is there not? You know, that there, it just brings a lot of questions to the table if people find out about it, you know, in a way that is a surprise to the rest of the coworkers or the rest of the team.
Tony, anything else you want to share with us on this Modern Romance report that has these numbers of a third of people having slept with the boss and half having had a sexual relationship with a coworker?
You know, I think being honest and understanding and knowing what the, you know, policies are at your workplace is really a step in the right direction to sort of mitigate and minimize any risk associated with these personal relationships.
Tony, thanks for joining us here on WWL. Have a great rest of your week.
You too.
Yeah, these numbers seem high to me, and it seems ill-advised, but, you know, the whole thing about the head and the heart and other parts of your body and what you're thinking with generally comes into play. And I guess ultimately I'm not surprised that nearly half of people have slept with a coworker. That one in three having slept with the boss does kind of surprise me. And that seems like a really, really bad idea. We're back after the news talking about drainage with St. Charles Parish President Matt Jewell. Thank you, Ian. We will leave that an open-ended question, and thank you, Joe. I'm Dave Cohen in for Tommy Tucker. Let's quickly change topics and invite in Matt Jewell, the president of St. Charles Parish, to talk about some good news for people, particularly in the Destrehan area. Good morning, President Jewell.
Thanks for having me.
Glad that you're here. Sorry to have led into you with that, but let's move on. You and the council agreeing this week to select a contractor to complete work to really help some folks who have for 40 years now dealt with flooding after flooding after flooding. Some homes and businesses flooded, what, three times in just a year and a half in the Destrehan area?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. We approved the low bid for what we call our CN Jack and Bore project. And essentially what we're trying to do is put new culverts, bigger culverts and more of them under the railroad in Ormond, where water really gets hung up on it. And right now the railroad acts much more like a levee than anything for these folks. And so you're right, for over 40 years, these folks have flooded. And when I came into office, within 5 months of my presidency, there was a flood there from a torrential downpour. And so we decided to roll up our sleeves and tackle this project. Many people said you could not do it. It couldn't be done. The railroad would never let you. And then you even had some people from a political standpoint saying that it was a simple fix, that it was just you just had to put a pipe under the railroad. It was going to be easy. I'm here to tell you that it was not easy, but it can be done. And we are going to be celebrating the addition of this and many more drainage projects across the parish over the next couple of years here.
Yeah, it got to be good news for those folks because, you know, at some point you just say, how much can we bear and how many floods can we handle? And when you have railroad tracks, which are by good sense raised up on a berm, which essentially looks like a levee, then you do have issues. But by putting these larger culverts in under the railroad tracks to allow that water to drain from this area that's seen these repeated floods, where does the water go?
Yeah, so once the water gets under the railroad tracks, it takes a series of canals and gets to a really substantial pump station that we have over on the east side of Ormond. And that pump station received about a $9 or $10 million improvement over the past couple of years to be able to receive more water. So proactively knowing that we were going to get to this point, we made changes at the pump station and the retention pond around the pump station to be able to receive this new water that we're going to be sending it. And so the pump station's ready, wants the water, and we are doing the projects that are going to get the water to the pump station, get it out of our watershed, and keep people dry.
So the water that will now drain more effectively out of Ormond will not lead to flooding in other neighborhoods or other parts of your parish?
No, that's absolutely right. And part of what we did by working with the LWI, and we got a grant for over 60% of this project, we had to model both the impact of not doing the project and the impact of doing the project. And so the impact of doing the project showed that we had about one-tenth of an inch of increase in elevation on the downstream side of this project, but all that was contained within the canal itself. So while there will be a modest elevation rise downstream of it, it's not going to cause anybody else to have flooding on the other side of this railroad tracks. And I know that's a concern from a lot of folks, but that's why we did this work proactively downstream at our pump station to make sure that any new water that was going to be coming across that railroad tracks that the pump station was going to be able to easily handle it.
All right. So what is the timeline for folks who have had flood after flood after flood there in the Ormond area? Some I know within 18 months have had three flooding events. When can they expect this work to start, and when will it be complete to a point where they now never don't still have to hold their breath every time it rains?
Yeah, so we're going to see the project getting started here within the next month. I'm very, very eager to sign the notice to proceed to get those guys going. And then the construction timeline is a year. That's what the contract timeline says. We're hoping that the contractor will be able to get it done sooner than that. There are so many conflicts within this railroad right-of-way. Railroad right-of-ways tend to have a lot of things like water lines, sewer lines, telecommunications lines run in them because it's an easy place to go long straight distances. So we have to do offsets and reroute some of those conflicts that we have there. That'll be the front end work that gets done before we do the actual jack and bore process where they push a culvert under the railroad. And we're not talking about just a regular culvert. These are going to be custom made cold roll steel culverts that are required by the railroad and in that permitting process we did with them. So that process will take some time, and obviously the contractor and the parish will have to coordinate with the railroad to make sure that you have no railroad traffic while that process is going on. So a lot of things will be happening for that first you know, 6-7 months, and then the actual process of putting the culverts in will go fairly quickly because the railroad wants to limit, you know, the time that they are down as well. So
yeah,
it's going to be a good project.
It's got to be encouraging that most of this work is not being done on roadways and in areas that you're going to have to impede people's ability to move around the parish to get it done, that most of the work on the railroad berm is off of places where people are driving their cars.
Yeah, I think we're going to see some additional traffic and construction, and you're going to hear some banging and loud noises from the construction. I can tell you, though, from the people who I've talked to, this is going to be welcome noise, welcome disruption, because they know at the end of this project that they are going to be able to sleep well at night, you know, when it's raining. And look, I'll just tell you this. We have completed or have under construction over $103 million of drainage work across the parish during my administration over the last 5 years. And we have much more coming. I mean, we just approved at the last council meeting, in addition to that project, an $18 million pump station to give permanent pumping capacity for residents in months on the western side of our parish. So a lot of good things are happening. We have so much more to come. And these projects are very complex. We often have to work with the railroad or state agencies and the Corps of Engineers. And so I know a lot of people are wondering, when's my project coming? I'm here to tell you that we have projects that are going to benefit everyone across St. Charles Parish, and they take time. And as they come up, we get them done as soon as we can get them done. So we have a lot of good stuff happening across St. Charles Parish for all of our residents.
We've seen concerns across the country. You mentioned that some of this money is grant money, and that must mean some of it's coming from the federal government, about recent belt tightening at the federal level leading to the inability to complete projects. Are you confident that all the money you need will be there when you need it to get all of this work done?
Yeah, thankfully, the LWI, which is money that came through HUD after the 2016 floods, was not clawed back. I think that was because of the time frame in which it was granted to the state of Louisiana. It would have been during the first administration of President Trump. So thankfully, they're not clawing back that money. But we were working as fast as possible to make sure we get out to bid and get the project started to make sure that money would be in place for us to keep this project moving. And, you know, thankfully, of that $103 million, about $40 million of that money is state or federal grant money. So we are really doing a lot of work to stretch our taxpayer dollars here locally and get as much done for our residents as possible.
Talking with Matt Jewell, president of St. Charles Parish. When we come back, I want to ask him about the fact that much of this work was done based on studies over the last 5 years or so on what the weather patterns were and what kind of drainage was necessary. Get a feel for if he's concerned that lately we're seeing more severe weather events than we saw just 3, 4, 5 years ago? And will this drainage be sufficient? And to what level will it protect the community in St. Charles Parish? I'm Dave Cohen in for Tommy Tucker. We're back after this on WWL. The New Orleans Saints are on the practice field right now for the first practice of training camp as the Kellen Moore era begins on Airline Drive. Today at 4 on Sports Talk with Bobby Hebert, Mike Dettelier, and Steve Geller, get the Cajun Cannons practice notes. Plus, on day one of Saints training camp practices, hear from head coach Kellen Moore and from select players. Join us 4 to 8 for Sports Talk here on WWL. I'm Dave Cohen, in for Tommy Tucker on your Wednesday morning as we talk with Matt Jewell, the president of St. Charles Parish, about some exciting news on new drainage projects that are coming to St. Charles Parish. And President Jewell, I know you said that, 5.5 years ago, you started working on this to make sure that drainage, which was one of the top concerns when you were elected president, could be addressed. And that effort continues today. But also today, we see more and more severe weather events. We're in an era where out of nowhere, we see flooding in places that have never flooded before. And here in Southeast Louisiana, there aren't many places that have never flooded before, but there are places that we're trying to reduce the flooding. How confident are you that as we move forward, these improvements you're making will be enough? And to what level are these improvements measured?
Yeah, we're seeing about the same amount of rainfall every year. But the problem is, instead of getting that rainfall kind of in a stretched out, you know, consistent way, we're seeing these bigger buckets dumped on top of us, which causes issues in the drainage system. So we saw just last week, as a part of that, you know, tropical system that was kind of moving through, that a cell popped up over St. Charles Parish and sat on us for 2 hours. And during that time dropped, you know, nearly 6 inches of rain, depending on where you were in the parish. We had a couple homes take on water. We had a lot of street flooding. Thankfully, it wasn't as bad as it could have been. It finally moved off from us. But when you're getting rain rates of over 6 inches per hour, a 10-year storm design drainage system just can't handle that, because you're getting more of a 25-year rain event or a 50-year rain event when you get into those situations. So what I will tell you is that the directive that I had given when I came into office was that at any time we need to change culverts, if it makes sense, if we can do it, if we have the room to do it, to go with bigger culverts. We made a lot of changes to our subdivision regulations that require new developers to use retention and detention to hold that water back and not dump it into our existing drainage system. And we're requiring new subdivisions in all of our projects to adhere to a 25-year storm system instead of a 10-year storm system. Now, what I can tell you is that the project that we are doing under the railroad, and this is a requirement of the railroad, and we are okay with this, is that you have to pass water at a maximum flow rate of a 100-year storm under the railroad. So the project that we have over in Ormond will have a 100-year flow rate under the railroad tracks, so it has plenty enough capacity to be able to handle those future rain events.
Yeah, and we should remind people, a 100-year storm means there's a 1 in 100 chance of that storm happening every year. It doesn't mean it'll be 100 years till a storm like that happens again, but clearly that is an upgrade from what you're facing now. And, of course, we should note, we talked about that tropical system that blew through a week ago. Well, a piece of that has now circled all the way around that high pressure, gone across the Carolinas, out into the Atlantic, crossing Florida, and is heading back to us, bringing us rain chances today, tomorrow, and really through Saturday. So we got to watch out for, again, one of those, even if it's an isolated cell, they could sit there and park for a little while and dump more rain than pretty much any drainage system can handle.
That's absolutely right.
Matt Jewell, anything else you want to share with our listeners as you continue to progress and embark on these upgraded drainage projects and try to address one of the biggest concerns that your residents have?
No, what I would tell you is that we are committed, and we have been committed over the past 5 years to making the improvements in our infrastructure that are necessary. Whether that's water, whether that's drainage, whether that's sewer, a lot of this stuff isn't sexy, but it is absolutely foundational to a community, and we are making the necessary investments to make sure that our community can function at a basic level, that when you shower, the water goes down the drain, that you have clean and potable water that you don't have to worry about, that we're not always under a boil water advisory, and that when it rains, the water drains and that you don't have to worry. And then we can focus on all the other fun stuff that we get to do in Southeast Louisiana.
And overall, and let's talk on the bigger picture about flood protection, we see the levee construction that's going on as we cross the Bonnie Carey spillway now. As we traverse the region, we see a lot of work going on to improve the federal flood protection system. And obviously, huge improvements have been made for your parish in the last quarter of a century. How do you feel now about your hurricane flood protection in St. Charles Parish?
Look, we are better protected than we ever have been in not only St. Charles Parish, but Southeast Louisiana. And I want to mention that all of the investments that we have been making in levee infrastructure, in pumping infrastructure, and recreational parks, everything that we've been doing, well over $100 million. During that same time that we have been able to do this, we've also been able to lower our millage rate in St. Charles Parish by over 13%. When I started in office, we were at over 118 mills, nearly 119 mills of property tax. We are down to 102 mills now, and on pace to go even lower. We're hopeful that we can get our millage rate below 100 mills and be the lowest millage or lowest property tax parish in the region. And so I'm really proud of the work that we've been able to do, and we've been able to do that by leveraging all those extra dollars, whether they're federal dollars or state dollars, to be able to deliver for our residents. And during that same time, we are now better protected than we ever have been. So things are really on the up and up over here in St. Charles Parish, and we are excited for the future.
And hopefully not only do tax rates come down, but it leads to, if anyone can ever understand how they determine flood insurance rates, it leads to lower flood insurance rates as well going forward. So hopefully you can save your residents some money at times when, it ain't easy with the rising cost of just about everything, including homeowners insurance, which clearly is separate from flood insurance.
Yeah, the flood insurance system is absolutely broken. It's not transparent. You'd probably have to bring me on for a couple more hours to be able to talk about that.
I know you've been in a fight with the federal government and FEMA over that. So.
Yeah, we sued FEMA because of the lack of transparency. We want to know how they're determining these rates. What I'll tell you is that it looks like they're working backwards. They know how much money they need to bring in. They're not worried about getting more people to join the program. They're just trying to charge as much as they can off the backs of people in Southeast Louisiana because of a failed federal levee system that broke during Hurricane Katrina. We don't think that's fair. We don't think it's transparent. And I'm working with our members in the Louisiana delegation to fight that broken system.
St. Charles Parish President Matt Jewell, we'll have to have another show completely about that. Time has run out now, though, so we'll kind of put a pin in that conversation right now. Thanks for joining us this morning here on WWL. Stay cool before the rain gets here, and hopefully stay dry after it starts falling.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Matt Jewell here on WWL. We hear across the country how malls are failing, closing, shuttering, can't attract stores. No one goes to malls anymore, but somehow Lakeside continues to thrive and grow. We'll talk about that. When's the last time you went to the mall? After this on WWL. Dave Cohen in for Tommy Tucker on this Wednesday morning. Been to a mall lately? Malls are struggling across the country, but somehow Lakeside Shopping Center continues to thrive and is growing. Aaron Graham is the marketing director for Lakeside and joins us now on WWL. Aaron, I got to ask you right off the bat, how you doing it in a time when malls are facing such huge challenges everywhere?
Hi, Dave. Yeah, well, we have a really strong team here. Leasing is extremely important. We're always trying to look for exclusive retailers that are not in the market and bring those stores to our customers here at Lakeside.
And along those lines, you have added a few stores just recently. Got a news release this week that three new stores are coming to Lakeside. So as other malls are shuttering and struggling to find people to fill retail space, you've got three new folks coming in.
Yeah, we are going to have a busy the next few years are going to be very busy. We opened Aloe and Mango recently in the last 2 months. Victoria's Secret did a whole renovation, and then I sent you, the press release. Rowan is opening. It's a piercing store, focused on, it's actually licensed nurses who perform the piercing, so that's exciting. And then that'll be in the Restoration Hardware wing. And then Vuori is another athleisure brand opening later this year, and Garage is also set to open this year. So six new stores coming to the mall this year, and then we have some more next year that I'm not able to actually discuss yet, but I'll let you know when it's time.
All right, so some exciting announcements and more to come. Have you had to shift in any way the demographic to which you're trying to appeal at a time when we see all the online shopping booming and struggles for brick and mortar to bring people into their stores? Have you had to adjust your strategy and which kinds of clients you're trying to appeal to bring into the mall, to the Lakeside Shopping Center, to get people to continue to come there and actually spend real money rather than just ordering everything on their phone?
So we've seen the younger crowd, they actually do like to come into the mall and touch, feel, try on the clothes and the shoes. So that's one focus that we're focusing on, the younger demographic. But then it's always been a strong female presence at the mall, right? So we hit every age demographic there. We have the older ladies, we have the mamas who are shopping for the kids, and then the 20-something, 30-somethings who, you know, come in to experience maybe some cocktails and shopping with friends. So we try to reach a little bit of everybody. And that's never really changed. It's always been something that we focus on.
Has the mall experience changed at all? For people who maybe haven't been in a mall in a while, is going to the mall now different than it was, say, 5 or 10 years ago as malls face these challenges? And it looks like in most communities, there's one dominant mall that's able to survive now, and it looks like that has been Lakeside.
Yes, recently we really have tried to create experiences here. It's not just about shopping. We have a kids' play area. It's complimentary to our guests. We do art and sensory classes for the children. I host a number of children's events here in the center. Mr. Bingle is a big thing at the end of the year, so we always host something with an event with Mr. Bingle. And then we do sip and shops with New Orleans Magazine, which has been a big hit. People come and shop. There's a happy hour from 5 to 7. There's discounts and incentives for the stores that participate, and we provide complimentary beverages and hors d'oeuvres. So I try to keep it fresh and have new things always here. We recently hosted the Jefferson Parish Bicentennial Ball in June. That was a huge hit. So we're just always trying to think of new things, interesting things that can keep the customers coming back, but then also increase their time they're here. It's not just about running in and grabbing one item. It's about the whole experience throughout the day and what you can see and have fun with.
Erin Graham, Marketing Director for Lakeside Shopping Center. Congratulations, because the challenges, I think, for malls are bigger than ever. And I really just was noted when I saw this news release. It's like, wow, how do they keep doing it when everybody else is having so much trouble? And it really is, I think, a testament to knowing your clientele, knowing your business, and doing what you got to do. As we move forward, do you feel good about the future of malls in general in Lakeside with the challenges that you've had to deal with increased online shopping and the ever-growing number of people spending more and more money on the Internet instead of in person?
I do have a very positive outlook. I don't think our mall is going to go away anytime soon. It's easy to shop online, but I think people still want to come out and experience a shopping day, whether it's with your spouse, your kids, your friends. It's a great place, and we're positioned, you know, in a great spot in the city, in the heart of Metairie, close to the North Shore. We pull, you know, from Lafayette all the way along the Gulf Coast. So we're a super regional mall, and we're proud of that. And we're going to continue to work hard and try to bring more exciting things here for our customers to enjoy.
And I know that the government of Jefferson Parish and the taxpayers of Jefferson Parish have to be very grateful for the fact that you continue to be this huge sales tax generating location when so many fears amongst local governments about more and more online purchasing taking away that revenue that they had seen, particularly when you talk about people driving in from New Orleans or from other communities surrounding Jefferson Parish to spend that money. Aaron, I know you got a meeting you got to get to. Thank you for joining us here on WWL. We appreciate it. And again, congratulations.
Thanks so much, Dave. Have a good day.
I'm Dave Cohen in for Tommy Tucker. When was the last time you went to the mall? And are you surprised that we still see some malls that are booming, like Lakeside, that are still enjoying huge success and attracting more and more people and businesses to open there at a time when it just seems so much easier to click it and get it delivered to your front door? 504-260-1870. Call me and text me now on the Elkhorn Art Jewelers Talk and Text Line. We're actually going to have a few minutes for you to sound off on anything you want. I know we don't get much time to do that here on this program usually, but we're going to have a few minutes after this if you want to call or text us at 504-260-1870. And you can talk about the success of Lakeside versus the failures of most malls now we're seeing across the region and around the country. You can talk about this survey that found 1 in 3 Americans say they've had sex with their boss, and nearly half have had a relationship with a coworker. Do those numbers surprise you? Talk about the trade deal with Japan. Wall Street happy with that. Anything you want to sound off about, we got a few minutes after this, and then we'll check in with Newell Norman, see what he's working on for the next 3 hours here on WWL.